This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There are parts of U.S. history that many people are not proud of, and slavery has got to be either on or very near the top of that list. And the history of slavery in the New World is entwined with another huge part of early colonial life, Christianity.
Christian slavery sort of refers to this argument that Christianity and slavery could be reconciled.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll open up history class and learn about the paradoxes and justifications of Christian slavery in early America. We'll also hear about a new requirement in New York State schools, mental health education, and we'll spend an academic minute asking why the Danes are so darn happy. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When Europeans came and settled in North America, they brought with them two institutions that would seem to be at odds, Christianity and slavery. The prevalence of slavery in the early American economy will always be a stain on the nation's history, and different Christian congregations had different ways of dealing with enslavement. But the fundamental question was, could slaves become Christians? And if so, could they then remain slaves? This is one of the many topics Dr. Catherine Gerbner tackles in her new book, Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. We spoke about the book, and I asked how she came to this complex topic and took on this project.
Yes, it is quite a topic. And, you know, the book's called Christian Slavery, but I actually started researching anti-slavery thought. You know, I wanted to understand the roots of anti-slavery. So I researched the first anti-slavery protest, which was written in 1688 by a group of Quakers. But as I did so, I realized that that protest was actually rejected even by Quakers, who we so heavily associate with anti-slavery and abolition. So I started asking different questions, and specifically about how Quakers and other sort of Christians justified slavery in the early colonial period. And that got me to this topic of Christian slavery. And Christian slavery sort of refers to this argument that these Protestants made that Christianity and slavery could be reconciled.
I don't want to get too far into the mechanics of this, but this looked like a massive research project you did. Where did you look? Where did you ask the questions?
Yes, it was a big research project, and I looked all over. I was looking at missionary diaries and journals, and I was also looking at, you know, law books, governmental records. You know, I read through every single law that was written in 17th century Barbados, for example, to try to get a handle of, you know, how slavery was legally and theologically justified. So it was, you know, a multilingual project, looking in English sources, German, Dutch, Creole, etc. But yeah, it was a lot of reading in these 17th and early 18th century manuscripts.
You mentioned the island of Barbados, and so much of this book is done in the West Indies. Was that really where was the flashpoint for all this?
You know, I think it was. And, you know, oftentimes when we study early American history, we just look at the 13 colonies in North America that became the United States. And if we really want to understand sort of our current situation and our history, we have to look farther. And the Caribbean was, in many ways, sort of the center of the English Empire in the 17th century. You know, if you wanted to go to New England, you often had to stop in Barbados because that's where the ships were going, because that was the economic center of the empire. And so similarly, it was the sort of theological center of the empire. Missionaries were going to Barbados, and sort of the real difficulties of trying to reconcile Christianity with slavery, that was happening on the ground in places like Barbados. And then those missionaries were traveling elsewhere, places like Pennsylvania, South Carolina. And so, you know, early American history, as we understand it, should always include Caribbean history.
Well, getting to the main conundrum of the book is really there were a lot of Christians who felt that you could not enslave Christians. Therefore, if you converted a slave, you had to let them go. I mean, that's a simplistic way of putting it, but that's kind of like the main thing there.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think that that fact has not really been widely recognized. Oftentimes, we associate sort of the history of Christianity and slavery with 19th century American history, where we think, oh, Christianity was the white man's religion and enslaved people were forced to convert. But actually, the opposite is true in this early colonial period, where slave owners thought that if you were a Christian, you were a free person. And so they did not want enslaved people to become Christian. And they made that the backbone of their legalization of slavery. That's what I found in the law books, for example.
What was the different views of the church being either Catholicism or Protestant churches? Were there different theories on this?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, Catholics, if you look at sort of the Catholic empires of Spain or Portugal, they have a completely different sort of connection between Christianity and slavery. For them, you had to baptize an enslaved person as soon as they were enslaved. And sort of the church played an important role in governing slavery. In Protestant colonies like the English Empire, it was different. So like I said before, Christianity and Protestantism were associated with freedom to the extent that Protestant slave owners excluded enslaved people from Christian churches. And so there was a really big difference between, say, Barbados, which was an English colony, and Brazil or Mexico, which were Portuguese and Spanish.
You did say somewhere in the book, though, that some slave owners used religion to control their slaves.
Yes, that could be a use of religion. But, one of the things that I try to do in my book is show how religion could be used in so many different ways. You know, so in 17th century Barbados, for example, it's religion is used as a way to exclude enslaved people from freedom and to justify slavery. In other places, religion could be used sort of as a way to try to control enslaved people. And, you know, missionaries who were trying to convince slave owners to allow enslaved people to become Christian, they made this argument really strongly that, oh, don't worry, you know, if you allow enslaved people to be baptized, they won't demand freedom. They'll actually be more obedient. And so the idea that conversion to Christianity could be a form of slave control, that really comes from missionary propaganda.
And it does seem that you give the impression in the book that the missionaries kind of did more harm than good there.
Yeah, well, they really set the, you know, it's a complex story, but they really set the groundwork for pro-slavery theology. You know, the 19th century pro-slavery apologists, they are using these earlier missionary statements to say, oh, look, no, don't worry. Christianity and slavery, they go perfectly well together, and you don't need to abolish slavery because it is a Christian institution. So they sort of ironically ended up creating a lot of different arguments for the propagation of slavery as a Christian institution.
Was conversion to Christianity sought out by slaves? Did they want to be converted?
Well, not everyone, for sure. But I think it's important to recognize that many did, and they did so for a lot of reasons that, you know, you have to put yourself back into the 17th century and remember that at that point, you know, Protestantism specifically, it wasn't just sort of, it didn't mean just being a member of a church. It was also the source of political authority, right? So you had to be a Protestant to be able to vote, for example. And conversion often opened up these avenues to learn how to read and write, and that's something that I talk a lot about as well. And so there are political reasons that an enslaved person might want to be baptized in a Protestant church. There are, because literally you can, in some places, you can wear different clothes if you are a baptized person versus a not baptized person. Then there are social reasons. Many enslaved people converted with their families. There were intellectual reasons, both sort of being able to learn how to read and write, but also sort of engagement in theological issues. And so there are sort of a number of different ways that we can understand why an enslaved person would have wanted to convert to Christianity.
My next question was going to be, did conversion automatically mean education followed? But was religious instruction also included there, or was it just, you know, here you're converted, now you're a Christian?
So education was important to the conversion process, although this also changed over time, right? So one of the reasons that sort of allowing an enslaved person to convert to Protestantism specifically is because it often meant teaching that person how to read and write. And these were extremely radical and potentially subversive skills in a slave society. So, you know, one of my favorite documents that I found during my research is a letter that was written by a freed African woman to the Queen of Denmark. And she's saying in this letter, which is written in Dutch Creole, the white people here won't allow us to worship the Lord Jesus, and you need to intercede. Basically, you need to intercede on our behalf. And this, I think, is a really good example of the sort of the mixture, sort of the surprising mixture of literacy, theology, and political power that was opened up when could be opened up when someone, an enslaved or free black person, was given access to Christian baptism.
I'd like you to talk just a bit about the difference between what was going on in the islands and in the Americas to what was going on back in Europe, because slavery in most of those countries was not as prevalent, was it?
That's true. It was not as prevalent, although it did exist. And there's a lot of interesting research going on right now sort of showing how there were actually more enslaved people in places like England than we had previously thought. But it's true that, you know, a place like England or, you know, the Netherlands, people there conceived of their country as a free country, as one that was without slavery. And then they saw sort of the colonies as the place where slavery existed. And so obviously these two things were connected to each other, but it was a real tension within these European empires. But, you know, the fact is that I've traced enslaved people who traveled back to Europe with missionaries and with other sort of white colonists. So they were a more visible presence than we initially think, but certainly not in the way that slavery existed in the Caribbean or North America.
Still to come, our conversation with Catherine Gerbner continues with a look at how the word Christian soon morphed into the word white. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Gerbner, and we're talking about her new book, Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. At some point during this time, the words Christian and white began to mean the same thing. I asked when this started to happen.
So that happens, you know, around 1700. There's sort of a transition period. But yeah, it's an extremely important shift that takes place, and really, this is when our concept of racial whiteness is created, is during this period of enslavement, and it happens for a lot of different reasons. But one reason is because as sort of missionaries try to convince slave owners that baptism would not free slaves, they argued that actually the justification for slavery was race and not religion. In other cases, you know, I've found sort of the introduction of the word white into the law books in Barbados. That happens in the same decade as there are finally there's a sizable number of free black Christian men who would have been able to, say, vote in elections. And so creating and introducing this word white and the idea of racial slavery creates a new way to sort of separate you know, true freedom from enslavement and then sort of a partial freedom.
Could you fast forward this today? And does this have any still have an effect on the way we either worship or view race in America?
I mean, I think that we are still living with the effects of this history today, absolutely. And I think one thing that this history can teach us is that we need to, well, about sort of race, I think everyone would agree, is sort of a central component of our society today. But I think that showing this history, and especially showing that, you know, the word white and the sort of the concept that there are white people, that this was created at a very specific time and place, it helps to undercut this perception that race is biological, right? That it's just something natural about us. So I think that that is one way that this history is sort of significant still today. But I also think that, you know, for people who are church-going Christians, you know, that this is an important history to reckon with, to think about the role that Christianity played in slavery. And I think that, yeah, absolutely, this story is relevant and really important if we are sort of committed to combating racism, whether, you know, in our society and in churches today.
I mean, there still is a difference between, quote unquote, white Protestant churches and black churches in just the culture of sitting in the room.
That's absolutely true. And this has to do with sort of the fact that white slave owners excluded black people from churches for so long meant that, you know, oftentimes enslaved and free black people, you know, they joined different types of churches. Churches were often segregated, and sort of the type of Christianity that evolved within black communities was and remains different from many white Christian practices. And, you know, you can see that very easily if you go to, you know, a predominantly white church versus a predominantly African-American church.
Finally, other than, you know, a very dense educational experience, what do you hope people walk away from this book with?
You know, I hope that they walk away from the book with a much deeper understanding of how the creation of race was political, as not just sort of a social construct, and certainly not just a part of our biology, but truly that, you know, that whiteness was created for a very specific political purpose of excluding, you know, free black people from voting and it reinforcing the difference between free and slave. So I hope that that comes through. And I also hope that people just recognize how important it is not to forget this early 17th and 18th century history because it is still so relevant. You know, Christianity and race are two of the sort of central aspects of our society today, and we have to understand this history in order to understand what is going on now.
Catherine Gerbner is an assistant professor of history at the University of Minnesota. Her new book is called Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. On July 1st, a new law took effect in New York State that requires mental health education in kindergarten through 12th grade all across the state. From Station WBFO, Eileen Buckley says this is the first law of its kind in the nation, and schools now must be ready by September.
We're available to work with schools on the curriculum, how to interface with communities.
Dr. Ann Sullivan is commissioner of the State Office of Mental Health. The Mental Health Education Act was passed earlier this year by the state legislature. Under a section of the state education law, this will be part of physical health education for all elementary, middle, and high school students. Sullivan tells WBFO News this is huge in helping to break mental illness stigma.
And I think that that is going to begin at the school level. of talking about mental illness, of talking about mental wellness, of talking about how you cope with stress, how you deal with, and it's going to be bound at the first grade and kindergarten level in terms of good social skills and being able to talk about your problems all the way up through high school.
The new law adds mental health instruction applying to all public and private schools that fall under the state education departments.
We want to, you know, normalize mental health and mental health treatment.
State Assemblyman Sean Ryan of Buffalo, the Mental Health Association in New York State, is now working to help schools comply with the law. Ryan says it's a first step, and the state education department is trying to help districts set up curriculums.
But it's up for the districts to implement. But with many things, the first year may be a little rocky, but the second year will get better. But by the end of the program, we hope to have it so people treat mental health as a common problem that can be remedied.
The state of New York has stepped up. We are actually acting as a model when it comes to education of mental health.
State Senator Tim Kennedy of Buffalo, he calls this new mental health law the missing link.
A missing component to education in the state of New York, and quite frankly, across the United States. So it's very important that individuals throughout not only Western New York, but the entire state, and quite frankly, the nation, have that education and that background to understand and to be aware of the signs and the symptoms of someone that may be dealing with a mental health issue so that they can get them the health and the services that are necessary and that are available.
A new school mental health education resource and training center has been established where teachers, students, parents, and guardians can go online. There's mental health training, instructional information, and resources. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
If you really want to live a happier life, you should try to be more Danish. And we're not talking about the cheese kind. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
As the gross national product rises, the rate of happiness in the U.S. is declining. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Marie Helwig Larsen, professor of psychology at Dickinson College, examines why Danish people are so happy and how we can emulate them.
The new World Happiness Report again ranks Denmark among the top three happiest of 155 countries surveyed, a distinction that the country has earned for seven consecutive years. The U.S., on the other hand, ranked 18th in this year's World Happiness Report, a four-spot drop from last year's report. Why might Danes evaluate their lives more positively? Danes have a stable government, low levels of public corruption, and access to high-quality education and health care. The country does have the highest taxes in the world, but the vast majority of Danes happily pay. They believe higher taxes can create a better society. Perhaps most importantly, however, they value a cultural construct called hygge. The Oxford Dictionary added the word in June 2017, and Amazon sells more than 900 books on hygge. Hygge is sometimes translated as cozy, but a better definition of hygge is intentional intimacy, which can happen when you have safe, balanced, and harmonious shared experiences. A cup of coffee with a friend in front of a fireplace might qualify, as could a family summer picnic in the park. Research on hygge has found that in Denmark, it's integral to people's sense of well-being. It acts as a buffer against stress, while also creating a space to build camaraderie. In a highly individualized country like Denmark, hygge can promote egalitarianism and strengthen trust. In the U.S., the gross national product has been rising, but levels of happiness have been steadily declining. Why? Because income inequality continues to rise, and because of a decrease in interpersonal trust and trust towards institutions like the government as well as the media. At its core, hygge is about building intimacy and trust with others. Americans could probably use a little more of it in their lives.
That was Marie Helwig Larsen of Dickinson College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.